through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
It's going to be a weird show, I'm telling you right now.
I feel like it's a great show so
well,
far.
Well, you know that phrase, hey, did you forget to take your meds today?
Yeah.
Like, I actually forgot to take my meds today. So this could
We're in for a wild ride.
Yeah, this could get really weird right out of the box. I'm just kidding. We do have a great show for you. Mike Salk's going to join us at 12:30. We want to start, though. I mean, the ultimate question in the offseason, before we get to, hey, how are we going to fix this? How are we going to improve this? Is to figure out, okay, did 2019 represent any actual improvement? We saw the Seahawks get to one more round in the playoffs, one more win in the regular season. But at the end of the day, did they actually come away from this year with a better team than they ran out there in 2018? And if so, how much progress, how much of a step forward did they take?
In 2019 compared to 2018, in this rebuilding, in this retooling process, I firmly believe that this team did get better in certain aspects, and specifically on the offensive side of the ball. I think Brian Schottenheimer, since he has come in to Seattle, has been a great thing for this organization because he has been able to establish the run in 2018, be able to get this group from being absolutely horrendous in the run game over 16 and 17 and got them to be number one in rushing. And all the while, they weren't elite in terms of numbers in passing yardage and passing attempts. But Russell Wilson had one of the most efficient seasons in his career. He threw for 35 touchdowns. He had one of his best seasons and also from within the pocket in specifically. Then you fast forward to 2019, and this offense made a huge jump and leap forward. They were statistically, except for passing yardage, which they dipped down in the last couple weeks of the regular season, they finished top 10 in almost every single statistical category. That is huge improvement. Russell Wilson has another phenomenal year, probably his best season when you think about everything that was on his shoulders, and at the first half of the season was far and above the rest of the competition. He played at elite level. Tyler Lockett has a career year over 1,000 yards. DK Metcalf has one of the best rookie performances at wide receiver, and he's continuing to get better and continued to get better as the weeks progressed. And then Chris Carson, build on off of a 1,000-yard season in 2018, has an elite elite year before he gets injured. So to me, offensively, they definitely got better in 2019, and they are trending in the right direction.
Yeah, offensively, it's hard to say they didn't get better. I agree with Jake. You look at even, the rushing performance yards per game total went down, but they remained in the top five, and yards per game just total went up, which means to me that they improved in the pass. And I think that part of that was passing more often than they did last year. Last year, they were the only team to pass less than 50% of all of the time. So of all the teams, every single play, every other team except for Seattle passed more than they ran. And Seattle ran more than they passed.
And they were dead last in attempts in 18.
Yes. And this year, they weren't even near the middle of the league, but they went up from 48% pass plays to 54%. And I will credit Schottenheimer with saying during the offseason, I think this was on 710, he said, yeah, we'd like to revisit that. You know, he didn't say they'd like to be a bit more balanced, but the impression I got from both he and Pete Carroll was that they would like to be just a bit more balanced. They're never going to be Kansas City or even Atlanta with Matt Ryan, but that they would have liked to pass just a bit more. And I think that the two most encouraging things I saw was that run pass percentage changed, and also that they made some adjustments before games, specifically against Tampa Bay, was the one I looked to.
This is why Salk is always telling you guys that he does that. Come this offseason, he doesn't want any money spent on the offense. And I think I agree with him.
Well, and I understand
because
why.
I wonder about the offensive line.
What about it?
And tight end.
The offensive line, you're looking at four of your five potential starters needing to be replaced.
Look at what Brady said yesterday when he was on the phone with us. Pete Carroll said, yeah, I'd like stability on the offensive line. But you look at it, your center suffered a season-ending ACL injury.
Also has $11 million on the cap.
Exactamundo.
But what are you going to do, spend all your free?
Your right tackle becomes a free agent. Your right guard... Well, I mean, is Fluker a free agent also?
Fluker, you still have him under contract. You have him on an option.
Your left guard, who you brought on last year, is not only entering his 30s and suffered a few injuries late in the year, but might not be here next year also.
Shouldn't it be Dwayne Brown, Jamarco Jones, draft a center, draft a right tackle, and maybe pay for a right guard?
Maybe, but that would still be a lot of change. That would be...
And a lot of youth. I mean, that's if you're getting an elite level... center, you're getting an elite level guard. So there's balance. There has to be a yin and a yang spend your money in free agency versus where you draft and you have to hit it.
Let's stick with the offensive line for a second here. Okay. Don't you want your offensive line to grow together? You don't want to be replacing pieces two at a time every single year, and even though they improved in 2018, I mean, the problem this year really was more health than anything. The personnel that they had was fine. But you want, theoretically, at least three to four of those guys to be together for like 4 or 5 years. And the only way to do that is to probably go through the draft and have them grow together. If you end up taking a step back because of youth, that's fine as long as they keep developing. Patience with the offensive line is not a new thing around here. Tom Cable used to tell us, it's going to be 6 weeks until the offensive line figures it out. Really? Okay. Go draft me two or three guys. We'll put two of them in there, and I'll be patient.
I think the only hard thing is that it is hard. It's going to be hard to find starting caliber offensive linemen three at a time in the draft.
And also, here's the other thing, is that is a philosophy that I think needs to change and shift in terms of what you're going to do moving forward. The Rams and the 49ers, where did they put all their investment in their division? They put it on their defensive line. Why? Because they know they need to stop Russell Wilson every single year. This offensive line over the last, since 2012, has consistently been in the bottom half. And in 2019, their pass pro efficiency or win rate was 30th. It was 30th in the league. And to me, that's something that you have to change moving forward to protect your $35 million investment.
$35.
just a simple drop in the bucket. $35 million investment. And also, if you can improve in that area, this offense is going to really take another major step forward. So I don't think that you have the luxury of just being able to wait six or whatever weeks hoping that some rookies are going to be able to turn it around. You've got to be able to have veteran presence that can play and be able to have a group, because also you got to look at this as well. You have a window right now with Russell Wilson, Bobby Wagner, for sure, in a contract situation, a 4-3 year window. You need to get it done now. In the 3 year, 4 year window. You can't afford to wait long term, next year, 2 years, 3 years from now as your offensive line is developing. So that's where it's going to be interesting. And Justin Britt, I don't think he's a foregone conclusion in terms of him being cut. I would imagine that the Seahawks would try and restructure his contract before they let him go altogether.
Even better. That's one less spot to worry about.
Exactly. But you still have to make investments. You have to get legitimate help on the interior in your guards, and you have to get a legit right tackle. So that is money going to be spent. And I do understand where you're coming from though, in terms of you and Salk, because you look at this defense, and you ask that question, has the Seahawks taken a step forward this year? The answer is clear-cut no. Flat out no. And you can look at it from a scheme standpoint, which I would agree with to some extent. It is very conservative. They ranked in the bottom half in every major defensive statistical category. And if you want to go even further than this, and Brock Huer did the work on this part of it, but they were the one thing they did great. They were fourth in the league in takeovers. They were 27th in yards per play, 27th in sack percentage, 27th in yards per rush, which is really the stat that you're going to look at in terms of grading how good they were against the run.
Play to play, yeah.
32nd in red zone percent.
Yikes.
32nd. And this is a team that's been telling us, this is a bend but don't break defense. That's not true. They broke a lot this year. They were 18th in third down defense. And the biggest thing of it all is they seriously lack blue chip upper level starting talent on all three levels, defensive line, linebacker, and secondary. And so they've got a lot to fix. They went backwards this year in 2019 on the defensive side of the ball compared to the offense.
This hour of Tom, Jake, and Stacey is brought to you by Car Toys. This actually syncs up with a question I think I've heard bandied about on other shows on this station, which we're going to get to later in the show. Right now, though, I have three questions.
It's time for Three Questions.
Can't wait for it.
Every day at 12 after 12, Tom Wassel's burning questions for Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
Enough with the "we got to protect the kids" nonsense.
Which two teams would make the best Super Bowl matchup, the Super Bowl matchup you'd want to see the most?
I think for me, I've just kind of fallen in love with the Tennessee Titans. I've fallen in love with the fact that this group, one, Derrick Henry, he is such a fascinating running back to watch. At 6'4", 240, 50 pounds, and him running the way that he does. But I love the aggressiveness in which this team plays. This is the way that, not offensive style, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying I love the aggressiveness and the violence in which this Tennessee Titans team plays, offensively and defensively.
I agree. They're one of those teams that when they start the game, mm-hmm. you can tell they're the aggressor.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's just anytime there's an underdog that makes it that far, it's a surprise. And you feel good for Titans fans, too. I agree with Jake. Derrick Henry has just been an absolute marvel to watch. I feel like it's going to end up being San Francisco and Kansas City. And that makes me curious as to whether or not you're going to have another high-powered offense versus a big, tough defense. You know, does defense win championships? What's that going to be? So I feel like it could go with an awful performance by Kansas City, or it could go with a tough matchup because either side of the ball is better matched up with the other, if that makes sense.
If Kansas City won that matchup against San Francisco, do you think the whole league would all of a sudden say, "Oh, defense doesn't win championships anymore. Got to go offense"?
The league? No. The media? Absolutely
yeah.
will
yeah.
say
1,000%.
That.
That's yes. gonna. There are going to be so many think pieces about how it's an That's offensive true. Reckoning.
The analytics crowd will have a field day.
But it makes for an interesting conversation. Like, it's a conversation I'd want to read about.
One of those conversations that would snowball into reality, though, I think. By the way, Jake, I'm surprised you picked Tennessee, the one team that doesn't have the big-time quarterback.
Yeah,
What do you mean?
Look, Ryan Tannehill's been balling.
Yeah.
Man. Look, here's the thing: is Ryan Tannehill to me, I think, is a great story. It's an awesome, you know, comeback story for him. And it'll be interesting to see what ends up happening in 2020 in the offseason with what Tennessee wants to do. But I just look at this team, and I love teams that when they step on the field, you feel their presence, you feel the tenacity. And that was one of the reasons why I loved the 2013-14 Seahawks. It's not just for the fact that they were great on defense and they had the Legion of Boom, but it was that whatever side of the ball was on the field, mm-hmm. they were the aggressors. You were afraid to go up against Marshawn Lynch, and you were afraid to get hit by any one of those defenders. That's what I really like.
It's fun to watch teams have fun.
Next.
Number two.
Does everybody know who Andrew Brandt is? If you listen to these shows enough, I guess you get a feel for who all the big wigs in the media are. Andrew Brandt is a guy who used to work for the Packers. He used to be an agent. So Luke Kuechly retired yesterday after 8 years, and I saw this tweet from Andrew Brandt. But it was kind of weird. He says, Luke Kuechly's retirement, let's please not refer to it as, quote, early retirement. 8 NFL seasons, more than twice the average career, playing a short area position. Maybe it's an earlier than it could be retirement, but not an early one. You guys agree with that? This guy's, to me, anybody who retires in their prime, or at least earlier than his contemporaries, it's an early retirement, is it not?
To me, it's a classic example of someone that's just stepping in there and being like, well, technically.
Trying to outthink the room?
Yeah, trying to outthink the room and show that you're smarter, show that you got this great opinion. And everybody's saying the same thing. It is an early retirement. And when you have to go into in-depth and in-length about to explain, well, it's not an early retirement. Luke Kuechly was one of the best players in the NFL, one of the most dominant Mike linebackers in the game, and a guy who absolutely changed the game and was a player that kept Carolina in their organization as everything else was falling around them with Cam Newton. He was a mainstay. So losing him is a huge impactful, is a major impactful thing for their organization, and it is early retirement despite the fact that he's had a very good long career.
Yeah, to give him, Andrew, the benefit of the doubt here, I think that the way I interpreted it was, well, the point is he's retiring on his own terms. What would a not early retirement be? Would it be getting knocked out of the game with a career-ending injury? Would it be being benched for a younger player? Like, does everyone have to go out in this horrible, awful, inglorious way to be a retirement on time? You know, what if you're going out on your own terms and you're, yes, he's young, but leaving the game because of all the injuries you've suffered rather than just pushing it as far as you possibly can? I thought that that's what he was saying with it. But I agree that it's getting a little nitpicky in the sense that people were shocked by this. It's like when Andrew Luck retired. With both players, there were plenty of years left to play. And so I think that the conversation is, well, in both cases, they seem to want to go out on their own terms. And I think that retiring at a later date would have meant that you are forced into retirement.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's unfair for him to compare a Hall of Fame career, that's probably where it was headed, and he may still go anyway, to the average career. The reason why the average career is, what, like 2 or 3 years, is because most guys aren't as good as Luke Kuechly. You don't get to keep playing if you're not that good.
My hand shoots up. I'm one of those guys. Exactly. I was forced out of the league.
Yeah, you dragged the curve.
If I could keep playing, I would.
You dragged the curve down, Jake.
Come on.
Way to go, Jake.
Jeez. All right, next.
I'll still play.
Number three.
You don't compare Luke Kuechly to Jake Heaps here.
Come on.
All right, which quarterback do you think needs to win this weekend the most?
Oh, that is a really good question.
And least.
Oh, wait, can we say our answers at the same time?
Yeah. All right.
Jake almost said no. One, two, three. Jimmy G. You guys didn't play the game.
Jimmy G, Aaron Rodgers.
I wasn't supposed to play. This is my question.
Oh,
I'm the host of the game show.
Okay, I was confused. I was confused.
Who'd you say, Jimmy G? I think Jimmy G
because there's been a burden as to whether or not the offense can prove itself to be as good as the defense all year. Even though he's had some good games, the big question has been, are you great because of your coach and your scheme and your defense, or are you great because of Jimmy Garoppolo?
And can it be long-term with Jimmy Garoppolo?
Yeah, because don't forget, they've already paid him.
Yes, so I do agree that probably the most pressure is on Jimmy G. I also think there is quite a bit of pressure on Aaron Rodgers. Aaron Rodgers' window is closing. He's not going to be a guy, I believe, that
he would be the guy I would have picked.
That plays like Drew Brees and Tom Brady late into their 40s. I think you've already seen his play decline at 35. And so with that being said, I think for him to show the naysayers that he could go against the San Francisco 49ers in Santa Clara and redeem himself from that horrific performance in the regular season, I think there's a lot of pressure on Aaron Rodgers in terms of fighting for his supremacy on the top of the quarterback ranking board.
How long has it been since a member of the media has suggested to Aaron Rodgers in a press conference that he's in decline? Because if somebody hasn't done that in a while, somebody should. I just want to see what his reaction is.
That would be a, that'd be a
like
great reaction.
He wouldn't hesitate to kind of shoot back, I think.
No, of course not. I think he'd go nuts. In his own way.
He would either go nuts or he would just stonewall you and never talk to you for the rest of your reporting
existence.
Career.
Yes. Exactly. By the way, Jake, when we were talking before about, or when I suggested that we get an offensive line full of young guys, did that just make you shudder?
Yes.
Thinking about Russell Wilson's safety or Russell Wilson's safety?
Yes, absolutely.
But that's the reason why you don't like it. You don't want to have patients like...
I feel like that's a baseball I just kind think of outlook. Like, let's get a farm system
the wrong
of offensive
approach.
Linemen
offensive
going line. On.
But you know what? If you look, I'm every year, I feel like John and Pete are going to hit on every draft pick. So when I say, let's go draft a bunch of offensive linemen, my assumption is that they're all going to be good. It's just a question of how quickly they develop, but they'll get there.
And history has shown that it is very, very wrong in that case. And if you're getting a center like Bradbury for the Minnesota Vikings who can just step in from day one and be your starting center, fantastic. But he was also a pretty highly thought of guy drafted in the first round. So if they want to get one of those guys, a Travis Frederick that the Dallas Cowboys got years and years ago, great, sign me up. But if you're expecting a second, third, fourth, fifth-round offensive lineman to come in and plug and play? I don't think so. And Jamarco Jones showed that he can play in this league at different times, at right guard, at left guard. But I'm not ready to sell the farm on Jamarco Jones.
Neither am I. I think you can stick him in at left guard. So we got Brown.
But what I'm saying is I don't think that he's at that spot where you can just throw him in and say
that
he's an automatic starter.
No, I don't think he's an automatic, but he deserves that chance.
He deserves
the
chance, but you've got to bring in somebody legit, a legit veteran to compete with him.
Hey, here's a question. I'll just add a quick bonus because we have a minute or two here. Should the Seahawks pick in the first round for once? Wait a minute. Do we have a first-round pick this
year? Yeah, 27th pick.
Mm-hmm. Should we pick in the first round for once?
Yeah, and I would even argue that maybe with their 11th, there's a couple different philosophies here, but they have 11 picks in this draft. To me, I would very much like to see them maybe once, maybe twice, to see them trade up in the draft to get the players that they want or trade draft picks for veteran players.
Yeah.
To me, that's where I think the best use of their 11 picks can go, and not just try and continue to stockpile on draft picks for now in the future.
And yep. I know that they always trade down, so fans listening are probably like, that's not going to happen. But they have traded up for some notable guys. More recent examples would be Tyler Lockett and I think Michael Dixon. Obviously, those were later round trade ups. So I'm trying
and
to think
DK
of a time
Metcalf,
when they traded
too.
Up.
They traded down, then went back up.
Right, right. But I think that I go back to what Jake said about needing blue chip talent at all three levels. I think especially on the defense, this year was this kind of exercise in Pete Carroll is this defensive backs coach that can do anything with any level of talent and they can still be great. And I think what it showed you is, no, you still need some proven talent there. You still need someone to build up toward the future. And the group that you got in 2016, the Shaquille Griffin draft, to replace your entire Legion of Boom secondary, you've got one regular starter from that group.
Right. And I don't even think, and when I say blue chip talent, I don't think Shaquille Griffin's a number one corner. After this year, I think he is a very good corner in this league. I don't think he's a number one corner. So I would love to see an upgrade at that position as well.
Where was all this aggression during the season?
There is a time to sit back and watch and look and move forward.
See, now we're learning things about Jake. By the way, I think that's a fine way to treat it. You want to give Shaquille Griffin a chance to improve during the year, not write him off.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he did some good things this year.
He did.
He was amongst the league in terms of passes deflected, but he also showed some things that show you that he's not a true number one corner in this league. So I think that when you look at all those moving pieces, especially on defense, they did not improve in 2019, and they've got some serious work ahead of them.
You know, this whole conversation is really funneling into a larger question about whether or not Russ's prime, so to speak, is being wasted. Maybe we'll have to get back into that later in the show.
I'm sure we will.
Salk joins us next, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Rost.
And Mike Salk joins us. Glad to have him in as we do every single day. Mike, this sign-stealing thing, I don't know. I think it's terrible, and I'm definitely like way into it. I find it to be very interesting. It's a fascinating story. When you see ex-ball players responding to this story by saying, well, this has been part of the game forever and so forth, how do you react to that? Because I find that offensive. Like, it's a dishonest thing to do in the first place, but we just sort of accept it. Now we take it to this otherworldly level, yeah. And it's still supposed to be okay?
Yeah, I got a few thoughts. I mean, the first is that this whole thing has just sort of made me sad because it feels like another bad news story about baseball, which really doesn't. I love baseball, and baseball doesn't need any more bad news. So more than anything, I guess the whole thing bums me out that I'm glad we're talking about baseball in mid-January, but I wish that the country was excited to talk about Josh Donaldson signing in Minnesota and what it means for the rest of the American League instead of this. So that's sort of a preface to it. As for the older players...
I mean older players. I mean all players.
Yeah, look, many players seem to know the least about baseball in some way, about the way the game is being played at the managerial and general managerial level. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Nobody knows more about how the game is played on the field than the players, and they understand the culture and what's happening and this and that. But no one understands less what's really going on with statistics and the revolution. They don't seem to... they don't want to understand it. They're, for the most part, busy just trying to play baseball and tell me what to do. Let me clear my mind of this incredibly complicated game and just go out and do my thing. There are players who are obviously handle it differently, who are into the stats revolution and this and that. But I feel like that's been the general principle of the way players have handled it. I don't mind them saying that this is the way the game has always been. That's how it's always been for them. That's their feeling. They're probably not getting deep into the details of exactly what went on. They're not poring over stories. They're just looking at it and saying, well, I've tried to steal signs. Yeah, my team tried to steal signs. This has always been part of what we consider gamesmanship in baseball. Clearly, this has gone beyond that, which is why you're seeing the major suspensions and the fines and people getting fired, et cetera. But, yeah, I understand, I think, why players are reacting
but,
that way.
But when they use that, when they use the phrase, it's always been this way, to mock people who find this to be dishonest and who care about the sport, I find that offensive as a fan.
Yeah, I think they're just wrong. I think they just don't know that it hasn't always been this way, that this is something different, that the Astros and Red Sox and some other teams went to a place that they didn't. Does that make sense? And that, so I understand where they're coming from. They don't make me mad. I think I totally understand their opinion. I think they're probably wrong. But I understand where they're coming from.
It's interesting as a player, you get wrapped up into it in the standpoint of, I think we talked about this yesterday, is, okay, if it's a player-driven thing and this is the culture that you're used to, and not every club, like you said, Salk, is going to the level or the extent of the Houston Astros or the Boston Red Sox, but it is part of the culture of baseball, so you just kind of shrug it off instead of looking at it for what it is and saying, no, they went to a whole different level, and this isn't okay.
Yeah, they took it to the logical conclusion, and obviously that's way over the line. You know, when I very first got into the sports media business was right around when Spygate had taken place, and I know that's sort of the story this will be most compared to, whether it's exactly the same or not. I interviewed at the time Tim Hasselbeck. He was one of the first people who I ever interviewed, and we were talking about that. And Tim was the first person to tell me about how, hey, yeah, we had people on every team I was on whose job it was to try to steal signs, try to steal signals. Now, they weren't filming them, and they didn't go through all of the levels of what the Patriots did, but he was the one who first told me about the Turk, whose job it was to try to figure out what was going on the other sideline. It's like, okay, well, that's fascinating. And it at the very least contextualized what Spygate was all about and how serious it really was, severity of it. Mm-hmm. Belichick went too far. The Astros went too far. They deserve the punishment that comes down, I think, for those situations. But I don't think it makes, like, I don't write them off as playing the game in a completely different way. They just took something too far.
What's a fair punishment for Alex Cora?
I think he's getting it. I mean, guy lost his job, which is a gigantic punishment, and that's a pretty good job. I mean, being manager of one of the you know, franchise, yeah, like the Red Sox, the Yankees, the Cardinals, these storied franchises, to lose that job, I think is pretty good.
But and we're expecting the MLB to...
Yeah, and it sounds like he's going to get even more than the year that the other guys got. So I don't know, maybe it's 2 years. I mean, a year and a half, a year and a bigger fine. I don't know. I don't know, I haven't been as obsessed with this story as Tom, as you were. I just find it to be such a sad...
Well, you're only on the air once a week,
no,
for
it's
your
not,
podcast.
It's not, that's not why.
I got 15 hours.
Yeah, bold about Alex Cora allegedly then being not just a ringleader in this, but taking one cheating scandal to another organization. That level of confidence that you won't get caught.
Yeah, and I've met Alex Cora, and I've been around him a little bit, and I know people that know him well.
Yeah.
He's beloved. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a beloved character. When he was a player, everyone knew he was going to be a manager. Mm-hmm. When he was a scrappy, infielder, utility infielder, everybody knew he was going to end up being a manager. He was smart. He was kind. He had leadership capability. He was great with the media. He was incredibly approachable and easy to talk to. And to see that happen to him, of all people, is surprising. I'm sure it's correct.
See, I think that's why these stories are so fascinating, because it's not like a bunch of bad guys were involved with a cheating scandal. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know how many people love the Astros front office, but there are a lot of players that
George
even
Springer
in Seattle,
is really well liked. Exactly. Alex Bregman is plays the game the
and
right
Paul
way.
And Paul Gallant talked about George Springer before being his favorite guy in that clubhouse. Well, and it's the same thing with, I'm sure, Alex Cora, like you mentioned, that they're, you know, what happens and how do we process when beloved people are guilty of something like this.
And this isn't like Barry Bonds where his head swelled up to the size of a balloon. Like, it's difficult to look at it and see that they were doing
and
something
exactly
wrong.
And know exactly where the advantage
is. Exactly. But they did. And I have no problems with them punishing him. I'm so sad for baseball that this is happening. It's my favorite sport. It's had, you know, issue after issue and scandal after scandal. And this just feels like another one that's piling on. It's just such a bummer to me.
We'll get to more football tomorrow. I want to ask you one more question about this. When you cheat, whether it's through PEDs or sign stealing in any sport, what do you make of the idea that you're taking food off somebody else's table?
This won't surprise people who've listened to it a long time. I don't get that bent out of shape about cheating. And I should. It's immoral. It's problematic. I shouldn't like it. I've never really thought about it that way. Especially in ways like this. I never really minded the steroid stuff that much. I don't think they should have done it, but I never found myself outraged by the fact that they tainted the game. I just thought, well, it was really fun to watch. And in 98, they really needed that home run chase to bring baseball back after the strike. And it brought people and made the game as fun as it's ever been in our lifetime. So I've sort of weighed those two things and said, yeah, cheating's not good. On the other hand, it led to some pretty great things. And I think from the commissioner on down, everybody turned a blind eye to the steroid scandal and just said, well, it's pretty good for business. So, let's just kind of let this continue and don't say anything.
Is there something inherently different about that?
These two things are different. The stories are different. I've never gotten that bent out of shape about cheating as a fan because generally I'm here to watch. If I were a player, if I were beaten by that team, I would be furious beyond all
belief.
Or
what about another organization knowing that part of that was carried out by a GM?
Absolutely. If I were involved in the game in some way, Tom, I think you're right. The idea of having food taken off my table would really bother me. As a fan, it probably bothers me less, and maybe I should be ashamed to say that, but what the heck? We're just here on the radio. It's just us, right?
I look at this cheating scandal, and it's one of those things you referenced Bill Belichick, and it just is. In sports, there is this moral ground. There's just these unwritten rules, right, of a situation where you're doing something that is acceptable across the league in terms of trying to steal signs. Then you go to that next step, and where does your mind have to go to convince yourself?
This isn't golf where, hey, you do what Patrick Reed did, you cheated. It's clear
Correct.
As day.
Yes.
There is no slippery slope that leads up to it. You just don't do it, right? This is not cut and dry. That's what I think makes this one so interesting. It's like, well, we can do this and we can do this and you can keep edging closer and closer to that line until the next thing you know, you're over it. It's not cut and dry. So it is messy. And there's certainly a lot of, Tom, I get it. There's a lot of conversation that comes out of it. I'm just so sad for baseball. And it just bums me out that we're sitting around, and we should be, but it bums me out that we're sitting around once again talking about a scandal that talks about this sport in a negative light once again.
Tomorrow we'll talk about something more positive, I promise.
Thank you.
Or will we?
Yes, we will. I guaranteed that. This hour of Tom, Jake, and Stacey brought to you by Car Toys. Up next, the big question on everybody's mind when it comes to Russell Wilson. 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacey Rost.
If you were to poll 100 Seahawk fans about this question of whether or not Russell Wilson's prime is being wasted, what do you think the percentage breakdown would be?
Right now,
yeah.
on Twitter, less than a week after this game, I think that 60% of people would
worry. Let's take the variables out of it. Let's go to like May.
I still think 50%.
50%?
I think it's higher than that.
Yeah.
I would say probably 80% of people think that that this organization right now is wasting Russell Wilson's prime.
Okay. I think that's, if that were true, I think that's way too high for one reason. I think this guy's going to play forever. I think we're going to get a lot more. Like, we talk about a prime. We're just speaking about Luke Kuechly a minute ago, right? And what a prime means for a linebacker. That's a lot shorter.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I think he was still in his prime for the record. But with Russell Wilson, as long as he doesn't get hurt, some kind of career-ending, serious injury, let's say his prime, what the 80% think of, what do they think, the next 2-3 years?
But I think you have to consider that I think part of, and I agree with you, that I think that you look at quarterbacks can play for a while. Like, at 32, you're still solid. You can get a big contract somewhere. But the contract is also what people are looking at when they look at that prime. If Russell Wilson reaches the end of his deal in Seattle, I have no doubt that Seattle will still try to keep him here. But I think they're also looking at that contract window.
It is probably that contract window that people look at. But honestly, I mean, at his physical peak, I think right now, I think Russell Wilson is I agree with you, Tom, that he is going to be a great player for a long time. I think a whole nother decade is he's got the ability to be like Tom Brady and Drew Brees and play at an elite high level. But for him, in terms of his athletic prowess, it's facts that right now is the physical prime of his career. And I think that when you look at right now, I agree on one end, I disagree on the other.
But you don't have to be at his absolute peak, or he doesn't have to be, in order for them to win a Super Bowl. Let's say they got another 7 years.
You're absolutely
out
right.
Of him, right? 5 of those years, he's probably still going to be good enough to win a Super Bowl. And I don't mean by the skin of his teeth. I mean by he's still going to be a great player in those years. You could turn the roster over twice in that time.
Yeah, but if you're an offense that relies on explosive plays or play action, there are things that you benefit from when you have a quarterback that's elusive and that can make players miss, or that always has the threat of escaping. That is a benefit to just your actual playbook.
He's always going to have that, Stacey. That's never going away.
I think from the standpoint of this, I think people code to that narrative from the standpoint of the Dallas playoffs last year and the first half of Green Bay. I think that's really where the conversation comes from. It is that stance that you don't put the ball in Russell Wilson's hands you don't put it in his hands enough. And I think that there's very much a valid point to that. And in the Green Bay game, I would have liked to have seen them put the ball in Russell Wilson's hands and use the run game as the secondary piece and allow it to be more effective. They did that in the second half. They let him go, and you saw what happened. I think that's part of the conversation. The other part is that when you look at this, you have to understand that this team is rebuilding. This is a 2-year still rebuilding, retooling process, and you have to be making the moves necessary to, one, help your quarterback be at its best, but two, to make this team not just get through the season, but in terms of the long-term play, are you building towards a Super Bowl? I think if you're building towards a Super Bowl, and that's what we're kind of saying in 2020, then these 2 years, I think people are saying that because of offensive philosophy, not because of where the organization is at.
I think that this team this year was built ready to go to a Super Bowl. I don't think they did anything wrong. I think I think that on offense, they were fine. Injuries, health was a problem. And on defense, they got Jadeveon Clowney. They got Ziggy Ansah. It just turned out to be a bust. That's all there was to it. I mean, they built a Super Bowl-ready team. Is Trey Flowers and Shaquille Griffin, are they both, you know, the corners you're looking for? No. Shaquille Griffin probably is, like you've been saying, a number two guy. But you know what? You can still win a Super Bowl, even though, you know, you're not stacked at that position, if you are stacked with pass rushers.
But I think I'm actually going to flip it and go to offense, because I do agree with you that you don't have to be stacked on defense to win, and you might just be a couple pieces away.
You got to be stacked somewhere. But
exactly. Yeah. You can't be depleted at all three levels. But on offense, I think that it's not just, okay, they've got the pieces and they're putting money in there, because you look at even, you know, when they got Rashad Penny, was at the 2018 draft, that was something where the entire offseason looked like a revamp of the run game, which Carroll values, and it's important to Carroll. But you didn't go out and get, as far as I know, linemen that excelled at pass protection. You got linemen that were really good in the run game, and your investments were in the run game. You got tight ends that were great blocking tight ends.
Correct.
And you got DK Metcalf this season. That was, if anything, a Russell Wilson pick. That was a weapon for Russell Wilson to have. But you've built this kind of holistic approach to offense as opposed to always building around Wilson. And I think that's what people are calling for.
And in translation, that has led to, in Dallas, right, you are in the playoffs. you don't run the put the ball in Russell Wilson's hands. You continually try and run the ball. And then in the last couple offensive drives, you say, okay, Russ, try and bail us out in this situation. And he almost gets you to that point. They're a defensive stop away, a 3rd and 14, from maybe potentially having that happen. Green Bay, second half, they finally let Russell go and they give him the football and they open things up. And he's one possession away, potentially, from bringing them back and winning the football game. I think people are tired of constantly being in that position. Russell Wilson is one of the best, if not the best quarterback in this league. But I can only imagine how frustrating it might be to say, okay, we'll let you do what you do best when the game is on the line and we need you to come back and save us. Right? Why don't we do that from the beginning? And I think if they can have that change in philosophy where it's not, hey, it's air raid, we're going to put the ball in Russell Wilson's hands 50 times a game, but instead of coming out with a conservative approach that constantly puts them in the hole and has slow starts in the first half of games, I think that's the narrative that people are going to be consistently frustrated with if that's the trend.
This sounds like a change of heart day for you, Jake. It really does. We got to talk about this more around the corner next. Tom, Jake, and Stacey, 710 ESPN Seattle.